to adjourn.
Good morning, you may be seated. Justice Plaker will not be participating in oral arguments today, but he has read the briefs, he'll listen to the taped oral arguments, and he will participate in the decisions in the cases. The first case is 002127, Corporate Staffing Resources, Inc. versus Roger Tracy, Tax Commissioner. Mr. Ehler.
May it please the court. My name is Tony Ehler. With me as co-counsel is Renee Corey. We represent Corporate Staffing Resources, or CSR. This appeal involves CSR's application for a refund of Ohio use tax that it collected from its customer, SARCOM. The Board of Tax Appeals below denied the refund claim. CSR appealed. I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. This case presents an opportunity, actually the second opportunity, for this court to address the resale exception and employment services. The first case was Belmar Parts Industries. The court decided that case 18 months ago. Needless to say, that case will play an important part in our briefs, and it will play an important part today. We think that there are three lessons that the court instructed us in Belmar. The first lesson is, despite the fact that in Belmar the resale exception was not applied, the court stated that the resale exception remains applicable to all services provided the statutory conditions are met. All services include employment services. Secondly, the court instructed us on what facts would make the resale exception inapplicable. In fact, it stated that where an employer contracts for temporary employees to come to its own facility and work on its own property under its own supervision and control, the sale for resale exception does not apply when that manufacturer later, at a separate time, at a separate location, resells the property that was worked on. That's when the resale exception shall not apply. By implication, the court instructed on what facts and under what circumstances the resale exception would apply for employment services. And the court offered an illustration in its decision that I would like to use as an illustration of that point. The court referred to landscaping services. Consider a landscaper that, because of employee illness or injury, is unable to fulfill its obligations to prune trees. It then contracts with some temporary service provider to provide persons that are capable of pruning trees. The landscaper receives a call. It dispatches to the customer's location one of the temporary employees. The temporary employee receives some instruction from the homeowner whether the tree needs to be tall and narrow or short and broad, and then proceeds to prune the tree. The commissioner would maintain that not only are the landscaping services taxable, which are not in dispute, they would be taxable, but also the landscaper's purchase of that employment service, that those services would be taxable as well, even though the homeowner is receiving at the same time the same benefit of the labor performed at his home. We believe that the court did not intend that. In fact, the court contrasted the situation in Belmar with the situation like the landscaper. And when it contrasted it when it said that an important distinction exists between the two. On the one hand, with the landscaper, it renders the situation eligible for the resale exception. On the other hand, with the manufacturer, the exception is not available. Those are three very important points that this court made and instructed taxpayers and tax enforcers alike. I would like to now refer to the facts and recite the facts in the CSR. CSR is a computer technology related service provider. Its primary offices are in Indiana. SARCOM contracted, that is, CSR's customer, SARCOM, contracted CSR to provide technology services.
You seem to make the distinction, and we've read about what happened with CSR and the difference in the facts, but you seem to make the distinction that where the service is provided is the distinguishing characteristic between your client and the Belmar case. Is that accurate?
I think that's partly accurate. We think that there are other indicia. Location certainly is important because it allows us to decide, separate the benefit of a service geographically. I think that when a service is provided at the ultimate customer's location is indicative of the fact that services are being received simultaneously by the ultimate customer and the middleman.
Could you have the location, geographic location, as it was in Belmar, and still fall within the exception?
I don't understand the question.
I don't know how to ask it any differently. You're making the distinction between where the activity took place.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. What if the activity had not taken place directly to your customer? What if it had done it like in Belmar? They did it at the Belmar or at the site of where the wheel rim was put on. Could you have a situation where that would even be exempt?
It would be a difficult set of circumstances to envision.
That is a material distinction.
It is a material distinction. I wouldn't say it's precluded because in Belmar, I think the court was persuaded by the fact that the manufacturer of automobile parts sought a service to improve a set of raw materials, which it then later sold at a separate time, and at a separate location, those parts. And what the taxpayer in Belmar was articulating was the fact that those parts were the actual benefit of the services. Geography played some part in that. But there, I think the court was persuaded in some part by the fact that it was a separate tangible piece of property. And that is hard to reconcile with the statute when the resale exception provides for sale in the same form. We had property there that was improved, but a service that was rendered initially. I don't think geography is dispositive, but it is material.
Well, in Belmar, the employees actually helped change the product, did they not? The wheel rims, they were part of the production process, whereas here, there's no change in the product, is there?
That is correct.
Why is that not a distinction that is important?
It is a distinction the court should make, whereas in Belmar, the temporary employees were preparing a new product for sale by the purchaser. Here, the employees are dispatched to render a service more efficiently, more timely than what the ultimate customer would have otherwise received under its manufacturer's warranty for the hardware. The repair services that the ultimate customer received on its hardware were repair services it was going to receive anyway under the standard manufacturer's warranty. Those services were going to be rendered within an allotted time, typically 5 to 7 business days after the report of the incident of malfunction. The customers could not wait 5 to 7 business days for the manufacturer, so they contracted SARCOM. SARCOM's task was to send out or deploy technicians capable of rendering a service quickly, within either the same day or the next day, depending upon the service plan the customer requested. And it is in that instance that we see, we get a glimpse into what the purpose of the purchaser was. It wanted people more expeditiously. It wanted the labor of these people. It already had contracted and received the benefit of a repair, but it needed people, it needed the labor to do it expeditiously. And that's what the benefit of these services are, and it's the same benefit, in fact, that SARCOM received. It needed people because it didn't have a staff to serve the service contracts that it was selling, and it received those technical personnel from CSR. It deployed them to the ultimate customer's location to work on the ultimate customer's property and, in many ways, under the ultimate customer's supervision. The benefits were received simultaneously by SARCOM and SARCOM's customers. It's illogical to say that somehow SARCOM intervened and changed the benefits of those services in any way that's material for the sale, under the sale for resale exception. This case is distinguishable from Belmar in that respect, and it does not require this court to reverse Belmar to render a decision in favor of the taxpayer.
Your situation, the way the service was afforded here, isn't that more typical than the Belmar situation in your business or in this business?
I think in terms of the amount of money spent on temporary employees, I think there's a vast majority of money being spent to replace workers online. Here, however, because that tends to be planned temporary hiring, there's no evidence in the record that that SARCOM planned and intended to maintain a long-term temporary lower-cost workforce. What happened was the salespeople for SARCOM were more successful than the business planners. Hardware was being sold in the 90s at an exponentially increasing rate. The customers wanted the services. It couldn't keep up with its promises to send technical people out to repair these services, so it had to get help. In that case, it sought CSR's services. But the record is clear. The witnesses testified that they would have preferred to have their own employees. In fact, the CSR employees were more expensive than their own employees. So there was no idea of maintaining a long-term, temporary, low-cost workforce. And so these are emergency situations that come up, perhaps 6 months or longer, that are attempted to be remedied because of economic forces. In the manufacturing context, I think the idea is cyclical, and there are seasonal issues in that particular case. This case is not Belmar. Belmar involved tens or if not hundreds of millions of dollars. We have $300,000 that will be at issue in this case.
Well, that's my concern, because I think that this is a $300,000 case, but doesn't it affect almost every temporary arrangement?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
That's why I was asking the question, isn't this typical? I mean, doesn't the employment service have people on its rolls that it sends to my plant to do whatever I need done? Isn't that what
But in most here? Cases, they're not being sent to their own customers' locations. For example, a law firm or an accounting firm might need temporary clerical staff. It comes to the law firm's location. It doesn't go to the client's location. The same with a manufacturer, the same with a warehouse operator. When a forklift operator is ill and they might need someone, it comes to their location. We're not advocating that the customer of the warehouse operator is receiving some benefit of that service. Those services are rendered at the warehouse. That's the typical scenario. This is unusual.
Mr. Ehler, I didn't find a response in your briefs. I may have missed it to the tax commissioner's argument that the JJ argument that the people here were not under the supervision of another, as the statute defines employment service. What's your response to that?
Well, we think supervision is important, and it was important to the board, and the board in fact found that as between CSR and SARCOM, SARCOM exercised supervision and control. That was necessary in order for the board to determine that the transaction from CSR to SARCOM under the statute was an employment service. That was one of the elements. It had to be under the supervision and control of another. That's what the Board of Tax Appeals held. As between SARCOM and its customers, who was exercising supervision and control, I think it's fair to say that both parties were exercising supervision and control. But it's not relevant to whether the resale exception applies. The resale exception does not impose a supervision or control standard.
So you, so your argument is that, that for purposes of a definition, that under the supervision of another, you take two steps to determine who's under the supervision of another. Is that
the statute is actually, the statute says both. In the first paragraph, it says under the supervision and control of another. Under JJ1, it says supervision and control of the customer. It's not clear, but it's not dispositive of this case whether SARCOM or whether SARCOM's customers controlled or supervised the employee. We think the facts are clear that they both did. There was joint supervision, on-site supervision by the customer, and initial dispatching by SARCOM. I would like to reserve 1 minute, and
thanks
for the court's attention.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, the distinction that the court drew in Belmar and is dispositive in this case is set forth in the syllabus. When an employment service is sold, the focus is on the labor. The purchaser of the employment service receives the benefit of the labor and typically exercises supervision and control over those employees. We need to contrast that with the product of the labor. This case, in that regard, is no different from Belmar. Here, SARCOM purchased the labor, the benefit of the flexible workforce, the labor from CSR. What it sold to its customers, and that's the subject of a finding of fact by the board, it sold computer maintenance and repair services. And in fact, it collected the sales tax, which was owed on those services, and remitted it to the state. In fact, Ms. Jackson, who sold the SARCOM contracts, testified that the majority of the business during the period was strictly the full-service insurance-type plan on workstations, printers, monitors from the technical services side. And she testified what the customers were negotiating for were the services to keep the computers up and running. That is to say, what SARCOM's customers sought was to make sure that the computers kept functioning. They sought that assurance, and they paid a contract price for that assurance, and they paid the sales tax on that contract price. By the way, it's instructive to note, even if a particular customer of SARCOM never had a computer repair problem, they would still have paid the full service contract price with the sales tax on top of it. So the notion that SARCOM's customers were purchasing the labor of the CSR employees is not a tenable notion at all. It might turn out that no labor was actually ever performed on that service contract. So what they were purchasing were the service contracts. The geography has become an issue because here it happens that SARCOM's business is to send people out to where the computers are located, which is where the customers are. But geography is not the dispositive feature. What is important is, what is it that SARCOM is selling its customers? And the board found that, in fact, that SARCOM is selling computer maintenance and repair services. It's SARCOM that is going to control these employees. And to me, the acid test is simply this. If one of these people, a technician, whether it's an employee of SARCOM's or whether it's one of the CSR temps, goes out to the site, tinkers with the computer, and it's not functioning, what's going to happen? Well, if it were a laborer, the customer of SARCOM would scratch its head and say, geez, we better hire better people. But under these contracts, what these people are going to do, they're going to pick up the phone and they're going to call SARCOM and they're going to say, you agreed to fix my computers, get it fixed. That's what they're seeking. That's the product of the labor. The labor was purchased by SARCOM from CSR. SARCOM sold the computer repair service, the assurance of a computer repair, to its customers. And that's the difference. Now, we believe that the findings of the Board of Tax Appeals really cover all of the allegations, and basically that the allegations to the court today are at odds with those findings. Specifically, at page 6 of the board's decision, there are several findings in the paragraph in the middle of the page. The BTA finds, given the record, this board must find that CSR was supplying personnel to perform work or labor under the supervision and control of SARCOM. Clearly, CSR employees were under SARCOM's control. The employees would generally begin their workday at SARCOM offices and would be dispatched as needed by Mr. Lawrence. While some CSR employees reported to SARCOM locations and completed tasks as assigned by the customer, it follows that the original placement of that employee was made by SARCOM, not CSR. Accordingly, the board finds CSR services were employment services. And those findings are backed up by testimony of Mr. Lawrence, which is at pages 63 and 64. The reply brief states that both SARCOM and its customers were purchasing a deployment of technicians to customer sites. No, they were not. The board specifically found, and in fact the record supports only that conclusion, that it was SARCOM that dispatched or deployed the technicians to the sites. In other words, SARCOM wasn't purchasing a deployment and passing the benefit of that on to its customers. It purchased that labor, and then it said, you go out to this site. This is your job to work on. Now, in fairness, you can say, well, did the board make a specific finding that there was no supervision and control at the customer site? No, the board didn't make a specific finding. But it didn't need to, because what CSR was telling the board is quite different from what its argument about the facts is to the court today. In its brief to the Board of Tax Appeals, CSR said, the facts in Belmar Parts are materially indistinguishable from the facts at hand. Belmar purchased employment services, the benefit of which was evidenced by improved or enhanced tangible personal property. Likewise, this is CSR talking to the Board of Tax Appeals about the facts of this case. Likewise, SARCOM purchased break-fix services, the benefit of which was evidenced by improved or repaired tangible personal property. And then CSR went on to tell the Board of Tax Appeals, SARCOM similarly resold the benefit of the break-fix services in the same form to its customers. So CSR was telling the board, the facts of this case are, SARCOM is selling computer repair and maintenance service to its customers. They weren't telling the board, look, you need to make a finding of fact that SARCOM is somehow selling the labor or enhanced technician availability. What they're selling is the assurance of a fixed computer to their customers. So it's not surprising that the Board of Tax Appeals didn't go off and cover all these all this with specific findings along those lines. We believe that the findings of the Board of Tax Appeals are basically dispositive, and that it's not really the function of the court this morning to try and redetermine those facts this morning.
Mr. Mayor, would you carry me through it, just because I want to ask you about the same thing I asked him. It seems to me this case impacts a whole lot more than just this case.
I think that's right, Justice Douglas. I think,
I'm not sure I can put my finger on it, but I'm going to read in the paper tomorrow that we've affected $3 billion worth of temporary help or something. And I just have that feeling.
Well, I think that if in fact the board were to be reversed in this case, I think it's fair to say that there's no situation in which the other side could not argue that there's a resale present.
Okay. I have a company that ships packages.
Yes, sir.
I ship more packages at Christmas than at other times. So I call Manpower and say, send me six temporary employees.
Correct.
Okay. They send them over to my shop and they help load trucks so I can ship more packages. Taxable transaction?
Well, Manpower is probably supplying employment service to the shipper by supplying a temp employee.
Yes.
Presumably, the shipper is controlling the employee at the location, and Manpower is actually providing the paycheck to the employee.
Right. Taxable?
That would be taxable, correct.
Now, I have one customer who generates more business for me than others customers, and that customer says, and I want to pack, have these packages packed the way you want to ship them, send me some of your people. So I call Manpower and I say, send me six people, and I tell them to report to this specific customer to do their packing.
Correct.
Isn't that what happened here?
Well, I think in a case like that, hypothetically, you have to look very closely at what the facts of the particular case are.
All right.
What
you're saying, that's a taxable transaction,
well,
even though those employees report to my customer.
It depends on the facts. It could be, in these cases, you have three entities. You have A and B and C, okay? A sends out some employees, and A pays those employees.
Mm-hmm.
And B says to the employees, go over to C and help C out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The question resolves itself to, is A a subcontractor, right? Is B saying, A, go out and do the work that I agreed to do for C? Okay, if that's the case, it's not an employment service, because that's JJ1. JJ1 says where what you're doing is subcontracting the work itself, then it's not an employment service. So if those were the facts in that hypothetical, and I'm not sure I can tell in a general hypothetical, I think you have to look at the specific facts, you have to look at the contracts.
The distinction is the actual service performed.
Well, I think the distinction is the distinction is, first of all, is the person who's supplying the employees, are they actually a subcontractor who's performing the service by controlling the employees at C's location? That was the argument that CSR made to the Board of Tax Appeals and was rejected by the board. They said, well, CSR were actually the subcontractor. We weren't supplying an employment service to SARCOM. Okay, that was rejected. The other possibility is that, in fact, B is controlling those employees at the location. Now, there might be a hypothetical where actually C is controlling them. But I think the difference would be, you have to ask yourself on the facts of the case, if C is dissatisfied with those employees, what do they do?
Well,
if they pick up the phone and they say, B, you agreed to get this work done, which is what would happen here. SARCOM, you agreed to fix the computers, come fix them.
Here, in our case, B is controlling the employees at C.
Right, that's what the Board of Tax Appeals found. And I believe, contrary to the assertion today, that CSR was right the first time, when it drafted the proposition of law on this case, it took great pains at the end to put on the notion that there was on-site supervision by SARCOM's customers. I think that would be essential. Otherwise, there's no resale of the benefit in the same form. How can you say that SARCOM's customer is purchasing labor if it doesn't control the employee? To purchase labor is to control the employee. So,
sure. Excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
Chairman Johnson, as you know, dissented in the Board of Tax Appeals, partially on the basis that the economic impact here seemed to be unfair, that there was really double taxation of these services, of the employees, the persons actually doing the work on site. What's your response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's an important policy point that the legislature could look at, but I point out that the employment services tax, by its nature, imposes a burden that usually gets passed on down the line. Even in Belmar, while you'll recall, Belmar sold the completed wheel assemblies to Honda, and Honda put it into the automobile. When Honda sold the automobile, there was a tax imposed on the automobile. Doubtless, the price of that automobile was increased by the fact that there was an employment service tax imposed up the line.
Well, yeah, but that's a tax on the sale of the automobile to an ultimate consumer.
It's ultimately the same economic effect, Your Honor. Wherever there's an ultimate sale to a consumer that's subject to sales tax, that's going to occur any time that there's an employment service provided along in the chain. And it really is ultimately no different from the economic effect that was present in Belmar.
So we should not be attracted to his argument that if the so-called regular employees of Sarcom were able to provide the service, there'd be no tax, but...
No, I don't think so, because the very essence of the employment service is, hey, when you go out and get the temps, you got to pay tax on that particular transaction. Now, if the legislature wants to rewrite the law, perhaps they ought to, and maybe that's a good suggestion for them. But the law that we have applies in this case. For all the reasons that I've stated, we urge that the decision of the Board of Tax Appeals was reasonable, lawful. Its findings of fact should be deferred to, and its decision should be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Ehler, you've saved about 30 seconds of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think what's important in the entire recitation of the case by the Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, was that not once did they concede whether the resale exception could ever apply to employment services. In fact, they suggested that Mr. Johnson's, the chairman below, was off on policy reasons that the General Assembly should address. But the General Assembly has already addressed this. They put the resale exception in the statutes. This court acknowledged that it would apply to employment services in some context, and these are the facts that I think the court pointed to when it should apply. I was involved in the Belmar case. There was a whirlwind around that case outside the court as to how much money this would cost. Justice Douglas, it's not happening today. We would know about it. We would have heard about it today. We heard about it in Belmar. We read about it in the paper. It's not happening today. Don't be fooled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ehler. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.